Welcome to the best of the RSN Breakfast Club. Here's a little bit of what we did. Take a listen.
Now, Andrew Mays has been part of the breakfast bite this morning. He's stayed on. Maisie, good morning.
G'day, Whitey. Chautauqua, he's stuck in the gates. Can't get out. What has happened to our man?
No, I don't know. I don't know what's happened to him. It's not like he's been caught in traffic or his car's broken down or any of these sorts of things. But anyway, I'm coming to realisation that it's not a dream. He actually isn't going to be here this morning. And that's hard to do, host the show when I haven't seen the rundown. I don't need to see the rundown because half takes after that. And I just, you know, just talk.
Well, I get sent the rundown every morning at about 5:20 in the morning. And I was looking at my phone, and there was a message that appeared from Joey saying, "Our man is down with a toothache, so could you be on standby?" And I thought, oh, he'll be right by 6 o'clock. But no, rule of line, which is disappointing for the punters. Even more disappointing for Daniel that you're going to bring back the quiz.
Well, I'm going to take the opportunity. That's what I'm going to do. Now, because of the chaos, I'm not really sure what's going on. What happened in the boxing last night? What happened in the boxing last night, Maisie?
Jeff Horn has given up his crown as the number one boxer in Australia with Tim Zhu. I know you are not the biggest fan of boxing, Waddy, but I spent $60 and ordered it and watched it last night. So
are you
he
serious?
Was all over
you
it
did?
Early, Tim Zhu. Yeah, I did. Yeah. Yeah. Spent $60. I'm actually a closet boxing fan. This is not something I admit a lot to any of my friends, but I really enjoy watching the boxing. And, so last night, spent $60, got the chicken and chips on the couch and had to wait. Well, luckily, it's a funny situation. Normally, these fights go until very late at night, but last night was over quite early because in Townsville, they wanted to go to bed early. So they actually scheduled the fight for 9:30. Normally, it would be about 10:30 or 11 o'clock before the main event comes on. But because they all want to go to bed early in Townsville, it was on at 10:30, which was 9:30, which was good news for all of us not having to stay up until all hours watching the boxing last night. But Tim Zhu was clinical, better technique. He's more of a pure boxer than Jeff Horn, who's a little bit of a grappler. The ref had to stop the fight 35 times to separate both of them because there was a lot of wrestling and grappling going on, more like a Greco-Roman wrestling at some stages, because that's all Jeff Horn wanted to do, was engage Tim Zhu from close. But, he was just clinical, Tim Zhu. We're going to see him do very big things, Whitey. I hope we've got his number, because he's going places. I know we've spoken to a few people on the Breakfast Club over the last couple of weeks, Australians who are doing their things overseas, but he's going to get some massive fights coming up in the next couple of years. He's a real shooting star of Australian sport.
I'm just amazed at your boxing knowledge. That it's quite incredible. Like we're talking to Paul Upham at the moment. I think we've got some audio of what happened overnight. First, let's hear from Tim Zhu, who was quite incredible. It is an amazing story, obviously, with his father, Ben Kostya, and he doesn't like that fact, actually. He actually says he's Tim Zhu, and that's how it's got to be. So this was Tim Zhu last night.
I just want to let everyone know that my name's Tim, not the son.
We know.
Look, all respect to Jeff. He's achieved so much. He's given Australia this platform. It's an honour to sell out an event like this stadium with another fellow Australian. All respect to Jeff again. He was a tough competitor. But look, this is a young man's sport, and I was better this night.
That was probably as big an improvement curve as we have seen from you in between fights. Do you agree?
Look, I said, give me competition, someone that can test me, and, you know, it's sink or swim. And I'm not going to sink. I'm here to swim, and I'm here to fly the flag for Australia and represent every one of these people here in Townsville, all over Australia, Russia, мои русские люди, everyone all around the world, because I want the real world title straps around my waist soon.
Okay, so quite a classy well, acceptance speech, if you like, from Tim Zhu. Before we go to Jessica Hull, who is going to join us live from over in Europe, we got to hear from Jeff Horn as well, because he went in as, I guess, the headline act in a lot of ways. He's had an incredible career. It might be the end for Jeff, and this was him after the bout.
Is it one fight too many, Jeff Horn?
Oh, look, Tim was young, hungry. He's an absolute champion, so I can't put anything past him. He's an absolute legend, so hopefully all of Australia can support him now. He now is the number one in Australia. He wasn't before this. He was saying he was, but he's certainly earned it now, and he's an absolute champion, and he can fly that flag very proudly for Australia.
How good is he?
He's very good. Look, he was on his game tonight, and I wasn't probably on my game, but that was all credit to Tim as well. He was outboxing me out there, and I guess he's got that young blood.
Where to from here, Jeff? Is it time just to go home with the family and have a think?
Yeah, it's just time to go home, give the girls a cuddle. Hey, Joe, Isabel and Charlotte at home, but I'll give them all a big kiss and hug tomorrow.
What's going on with Jeff there, Maisie? He seems a little bit worse for wear. Has he got a cold, or is he just been bashed up?
No, he's had he actually didn't have a cold. They think he might have been punched in the throat in sparring a couple of weeks ago. But you know how Jeff is the school teacher, kind of a bit. It's like your next door neighbour half the time up there fighting. He's not really got the trash talk down pat either. He said last night on Fox Sports that he might just be going through puberty before the fight to Eddie Maguire. This was 20 minutes before he went on stage. So, that might be the end. But, I mean, he's become a household name in Australia. What a story. The man who was a high school teacher who took on Manny Pacquiao in one of the biggest fights Australia's ever seen. And now that might be it. But what a career he's had over the last 5 years.
Jessica Hull joins us on RSN on this Thursday morning. She's over in Europe in the morning, and some incredible news coming out of Jessica at the moment. Jessica, thanks very much for joining us.
No worries. Thanks for having me, guys.
Now, I've got to ask you straight up, share with our listeners where you actually are at the moment in the world.
So I am in Stockholm, Sweden right now, and tomorrow I move across to Gothenburg, or Gothenburg, it's spelt different ways each time I see it on paper, so yeah. I'm not exactly sure how you pronounce it. But, it's been cool. The last week we've been in the city in Stockholm, and then tomorrow we get to go out to the outskirts and be a bit more coastal.
Okay, so what's it like over there in the moment? Every time we talk to an athlete around the world, we've got to ask about, from a coronavirus perspective, how life is where you currently are. What's it like?
It's almost a little bit too normal in a way. Like, no one is wearing masks, and it's not like when you go to the shops or anything at home and there's hand sanitizers everywhere now. That's a lot fewer and far between. So they have kind of gone back to a little bit more normality here. Social distancing is a very foreign concept. I think that term has been lost on Europe. But at the same time, we're just doing everything we can do with the good habits that we had in place when I was in Australia and my teammates were still back at home in the US. So we're just making sure we keep our distance, make sure we carry our own sanitizers and wear our masks. And if the elevator's full, you wait and take the next one. Like, just do our little bit to try and minimize exposure. But, yeah, apart from what we're doing proactively ourselves, it's almost pretty normal life here, which is a bit crazy.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Now, before we talk to you about specifically the amazing thing you've done recently, when did you leave Australia? And take us through that process of jumping on a plane and leaving the country when so many people can't, and to going over into Europe, and explain your overall experience to this point.
Yeah, so I left on, I think it was about the 7th of August. And it was a process to get the approval to leave Australia. But luckily, I was able to get that all through. And then the airport was a very lengthy process, because when you get approved to travel, you just receive an email that says you've been approved to travel. If your port of exit or time changes, you do not need to notify us. It's just saying that you can leave whenever you want, basically. But then when you get to the airport, they have to call Canberra and call the Department of Home Affairs, and then they'll give you a whole receipt number that's specific to you. So the check-in process at the airport is pretty lengthy. And then it was kind of the first flight that I had was Sydney to Doha and then Doha on to London. And it was kind of a little bit stressful, more in the fact of, like, I hadn't been around a lot of people. Like, I had my circle at home was pretty small, and I'd only really been around my family and the people I'd been training with. So to then be in an airport with a lot of people coming from a lot of different places, if you start to think about it, it's a bit scary because you just can't really control where they have been prior to sitting opposite you in the airport lounge. But as I got further into the travel, I got a bit more comfortable about it, and I just thought, well, you know, as long as I'm doing as much as I can to make sure I stay healthy and minimize the chance that I'm going to contract the virus, then that's all I can do at this point in time. And I wouldn't go over there and race, and it's part of my job, so I just have to make sure I'm being as careful as possible.
Jess, one more before we get onto the 5,000-metre record. Tell us about the Diamond League this year. It's a huge event, obviously, over in Europe every summer. And, you know, I was lucky enough to spend one summer over there, and it's on the main channels on free-to-air TV in the UK, which I found quite extraordinary. Tell us about what the makeup is of it this year, obviously, with the Olympics supposed to be scheduled, and how it's running this year.
Yeah, so it's been a delayed season. Initially, this usually kicks off in May and starts in Doha and makes its way across to the US and then for Europe. And about, I would say, probably 60% of the meets this year haven't gone ahead, which there's usually about 12 of them that culminate in you gain points all season to qualify for the finals. And there's a lot of prize money along the way, those kinds of things that, this year, with the minimized schedule and the need to, when you stay in a meet hotel, no one has to share rooms this year because you can't really share with someone coming from a different part of the world. So budgets have been restructured, which has meant, like, different TV stations are playing a lot of the meets. And for my family at home, it's been good that they've been able to just watch straight from YouTube. So that's been nice this year that they haven't had to scrounge around and find where it's going to be played. But, yeah, so the prize money has been slashed dramatically in order to make sure that safety protocols can be put in place with those budgets instead. So we all have a COVID test 48 hours before the meet begins. And until the results of that come back, there's no mixed zones or anything. So there's no communal dining or any of those sorts of things until about 36 hours out from the meet when everyone's got their hopefully negative COVID test. And then if there was to be a positive case, they have time to kind of step in and make sure that person doesn't expose the rest of the meet to the virus. So they've taken the precautions, they've adjusted accordingly, and they've been doing an incredible job to give us opportunities that we didn't think we were going to have a few months ago.
On one day cricket, we haven't been where we need to be in the world rankings, and we haven't been as consistent. So this is just another step to growing our team, leading, sort of working back from the 2023 50 over World Cup. So obviously we want to win. Goes without saying. But as long as we keep improving as a team and improving as players, I think that will hold us in good stead going forward.
That was Aaron Finch. We spoke to Finchie on the program just before they headed over to the UK, the Australian team, for some one-day internationals and some T20s. They've arrived in the UK. They're in Derby at the moment, where we also find Adam Collins in the UK, who's just covered... Well, he's been covering some county cricket. He's also been covering the recent test series between England and Pakistan. Collo, good morning, and where do we find you?
Hello, Whitey. I'm on the banks of the Thames. I'm looking at London Bridge as we speak, actually. So it's a lovely setting. Very nice. Is it a Wednesday night? Beautiful.
Very, very nice. Before we get to the Australian side of things, because they have arrived in the country you currently reside in, what was the sort of the wash up of the Test series with Pakistan? Obviously, rain played a key part in not only the Pakistan series but the West Indian series. Did England do enough to impress you?
Oh, look, they did. I mean, when you consider they lost the first test match of the summer to the West Indies and bounced back and won 2-1, they won the first test against Pakistan after being well behind in the test match, 107 behind on the first innings, and found a way to scrap their way to a result courtesy of Chris Wakes, Josh Butler there. Of course, two relatively sodden and sorry draws at Southampton, which obviously no one could do anything about, but that was the way it went. And really, the narrative shifted to whether James Anderson would, well, he would play in the first instance. There was a big chat that he'd be left out of the second test, but they picked him. He played there, and then in the third test match, picked up his 600th wicket. So in terms of what England learnt, I mean, you could argue that they already knew that Anderson and Broad could bowl teams out in English conditions, absolutely. But the longer-term project of being able to, say, win in Australia with Jofra Archer, who didn't particularly impress against Pakistan, although he did have limited opportunities, and Mark Wood, who is the player they have really identified as someone who can play and do well in Australia and in foreign conditions, and understandably so, given the way that he bowled in the Caribbean last year and the West and South Africa earlier this year. He only played one test match. So, look, there's definitely good signs as far as Anderson still delivering at this age and Broad remaining at the peak of his powers. But as far as that pace artillery about Archer and Wood on Australian tracks, which might be a fraction less responsive, I suppose there's still some questions to answer as they go into their winter.
So two questions I've got for you on the series that's taken place. Firstly, with Jimmy Anderson, who got to 600 test wickets. As you said, there was a thought that he might not have played that last test. Is that it for him? Will he retire now, or will he go on and play for longer, even longer?
Yeah, well, look, talking to Jimmy, he wants to play until the 21-22 Ashes series. And to an extent, I can understand that. I mean, of course, that success in 10-11 where he bowled so beautifully, and in 13-14 where he did a lot of things right, but his batsman obviously let him down, and Mitchell Johnson dominated, and then 17-18 where they were kind of outclassed from the get-go. To an extent, I feel as though he sees that next tour as an opportunity to put a cherry on top of his career. But he doesn't really need to, I suppose, is the other way of interpreting it. I mean, if you sent him out to Australia again on tracks which probably won't be responsive to the type of bowling which has been his bread and butter for so many years, there's some talk that he might stick around as like a bowling mentor, almost like a playing assistant coach, which isn't completely crazy. I mean, if you've got a bowler of James Anderson's capacity with what he does to play at, let's say, hypothetically, Adelaide under lights with a pink ball, well, you'll pick him, obviously. But whether he'll necessarily be there for five test matches and leading the attack is a different proposition altogether. I think in the short term, they go to Sri Lanka in the winter and the UAE to play India. I don't expect he'll play too much over there, but next year, next summer for England, they're hosting India at the start of the next World Test Championship cycle, and he's got a fabulous record against India in home conditions, and why wouldn't they play him? I mean, he does so well over here. He's fit as a fiddle. He might be 38 years old, but he certainly doesn't look it or give the impression of a guy that's coming to the end in terms of his skill set. So it might be the case that they continue to use him at home more often than not and selectively away from home until he reaches the point when they think they've moved on from him. But, I mean, on the available evidence, he's still got some gas in the tank.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And Zach Crawley, the amazing story. And look, 260-odd in his latest test match. Mm. England have been sort of crying out for top-order players now for quite some time, particularly since Alistair Cook retired. Now, I know he's not an opener, but just even to give that additional protection to Joe Root, have they found someone here?
Yeah, it's an interesting point because he did start his career as an opener, and I think that it's entirely plausible to think that he will open when they come to Australia next year because they're going to have to... Look, I say this to an extent with the big caveat that it is England after all, but they're going quite nicely with the bat at the moment, and they have to fit Ben Stokes into that top six when he returns from the lead that he's been on over the last couple of test matches due to that family issue that he's been dealing with back in New Zealand. So, to an extent, I think that Crawley might be the opener. But the thing to understand about Zach Crawley is that he's been prepared for this and been cultivated for this role since he was 14 years old. He's he has an apartment next to the county ground at Kent. He's been mentored from that young age by very senior players. He's been given every opportunity to develop his skills. The reason why he was picked for England with a first-class batting average of 30 was because they saw something in him that will be more important than his statistical output when he's playing first-class cricket. And that was, I suppose, realised this week at Southampton. So he's got an organised technique, he's tall, He doesn't mess around too much in the crease. He obviously strikes the ball beautifully, goes at a decent tempo. He's batted at a strike rate of about 65 throughout the course of the summer. So they see him as an option who can take it back to the Australians. And another part of this Zach Crawley story is that over the last three winters, he's actively sought himself great opportunities to play club cricket in Australia. So he wants to be ready and harden himself up for what could be an Ashes battle in 2021-22. So you can kind of see that they have invested in this guy, even though his numbers for Kent don't necessarily warrant it. And now he's delivered on that. He's doing the spade work in the winter, and I think they've kind of found one, really. When you look at the way he played against Shaheen Afridi, Nasim Shah and Mohammed Abbas, I mean, they're fantastic bowlers, and he made them look like club bowlers occasionally. He was so dominant. So even though he's obviously not the finished product yet at age 22, I expect that a lot of their planning for the next Ashes series will revolve around him.
What are your thoughts on Thursday night footy, Jono? Two games tonight. It's like an afternoon game and then a night game.
Yeah, look, it's you know how excited I get, Whitey, when Thursday night footy's on. So I love starting Thursday nights. Getting in, it's the start of the weekend now in a way. I think it's been really good. The more Thursday night games we're seeing, the better it's been. The frenzy's been amazing, but now back to a little bit of normality over the last week before we all kickstart again, leading into the end of the season. Tonight's going to be really good. Obviously, the intrigue around Joey Danaher's return for the Bombers, I think that's what everyone's going to sit back and watch initially, see what sort of impact he can have on the game of footy against the Hawks. And then you've got a huge game. It really is. Richmond and West Coast is massive in terms of the context of both their seasons, searching for that top four spot. West Coast 2 points in front of Richmond at the moment, so they can get that break on them if they have a win in terms of their pursuit for top four and they haven't lost in a couple of months anyway. The West Coast Eagles and the Tigers are back in some serious shape, so that's going to be an absolute river. So we'll have the entree, and then the main course is going to be absolutely sensational.
Yeah, look, we might go through them in Racebook order, if you like, with the Essendon Hawthorn game first. Before we get your thoughts on Joe Danaher playing tonight, Jono, here is John Worsfold, who confirmed the news yesterday that Joe would be playing his first game in well over 12 months.
Obviously, we had a little setback with his calf injury a month ago. We would have been at this point a little bit earlier. Joe's been working his backside off to get himself back to reignite his footy career. He's enjoyed being up here with the guys. He's been really positive around everyone. He's been working extremely hard, but supporting a lot of the younger players that have been getting some opportunities this year. So it's just been good to have him around in this full-time environment. Because of his program, up until we moved up here, we didn't actually spend a lot of time around Joe because he was in a different training group. Obviously, Joe knows the club. Wants him to stay. We'd love him to play out his whole career at the Essendon Footy Club. But there's going to be a new coach next year, and those discussions are going to be more heavily involved with Ben and list management group going forward. But obviously it rests with Joe's desires mainly.
So five games to go, Jono. Joe gets a chance to play. What are your thoughts on him? I won't say being rushed back because he's missed so much footy, but no scrimmage match, obviously no opportunity to play in a VFL game. What do you think?
I think there's obviously some small risks associated with it because you haven't had that full, match simulation, I suppose, in terms of having a full practice match or going back and playing in the VFL for a couple of weeks just to, get yourself going and make sure that your touch and your body can recover and you can actually have more confidence in yourself going through there. There's no doubt that he would have, he won't second guess himself, but at leading into the game, there's just that question mark, I suppose, in your mind coming off a big layoff, what is going to happen tonight? So there's a little bit of the unknown, I suppose, is the right word in terms of, your preparations. You're confident, but there's always that little but there when you're coming off that long layoff. So ultimately, it's a huge night for Joe. Essendon fans will be loving the fact. We're loving the fact that Joe's back. And all we want to see him is get through the next 4 or 5 weeks, maybe even play some big finals for the Bombers. The other questions, they'll answer themselves in the next couple of months anyway. Joe at the right time and the club will will talk and announce those sort of things. We know those discussions are going to happen. It's just timing on those. So we can't dictate when they will be. Yes, we'll continue to ask the question about how the whole relationship and everything is going, but I think his football will determine that over the next couple of weeks anyway.
How important was it for him to play in these last five rounds, Jono? Not only from Essendon's perspective, but for Joe personally as well.
Oh, I think it's big in the fact that, you know, he's had these injury setbacks along the way, and, you know, he wouldn't ever have questioned that he couldn't get back. It's just now the impact he can have now that he is fit and ready to come back. And I think his impact will be quite significant. It mightn't be tonight, but it'll grow. This guy can seriously play. We see what the King boys are doing in terms of their height and agility and those sort of things for their clubs. Joe's going to do the same thing for Essendon. And I think the way that the game has sort of gone this year will start to suit a Joe Danaher on return anyway, because they can play him out of the goal square, you know, more often. That he won't have to leave forward 50 to go and defend, you know, and compress the ground right up, because teams are starting to lengthen the ground a little bit. And Essendon play that way in terms of just, you know, lengthening that ground, keeping their forwards more at home. So I think this sort of style of football that they play and what we're starting to see more often will suit Joe Danaher on return anyway, because he's going to play maybe out of the square and not have to get up the ground, let others do that initially.
I've got one question for you, Whitey. From a media perspective, we were listening to John Worsfold before saying the decision is about Joe and his future will be made, obviously, a lot more by Ben Rutten than him. Would it be nice for the Essendon fans to hear from Ben Rutten and what he thinks about Joe Danaher and his role going forward with the footy club?
What's he going to say?
Well, he's obviously going to say, you know, I look forward to him playing here, or he might, you know, open up a little bit on Joe's journey and his relationship with Joe.
Yeah, I think everyone wants to hear a little bit more of Ben Rutten now, because yeah, we are sort of, you know, four or five games away from him being in control. But I think it's more you see Ben Rutten sort of coaching the team week to week at the moment, Jono, in the box, that maybe the time has come for Ben to start to do the post-game press conferences, if he's the one that's in charge on game day. Look, it's always going to be a difficult process, this transition as to who is the figurehead, if you like, because at the end of the day, it still is John Worsfold. It's still his team, but it feels like that it's Ben coaching on match day. So I'm not sure, but I think we've got to start to hear a little bit more from Ben to answer your question.
Yeah, I think so as well. And I think that's the green light from John Worsfold in throughout that interview, saying that, you know, the decisions behind the doors now will be the list management will be with Ben Rutten as those discussions start to happen now until the end of the year. They're making decisions on players' futures, what Ben would like to come into the club in the future as well. I think that's really important to understand, that he might be looking for a certain type of player that he thinks will help the footy club, whether that is through a trade or whether that is a young player through the draft that they will look at getting into the footy club. So I think it's now, yeah, you're right. Maybe it's not so much post-game. I think it's still John until the end of the year in all those sort of game day footy aspects of things, because the buck is stopping with him at this current time. But I think more during the week and the way that things are starting to shape from a club point of view, and if there's questions around the club point of view, I think that's where the football's going in the future. That's where Ben, I think, needs to now probably start to address things more often. And as I said, I think that's the green light from John, because he's basically said it there that, you know, this is going to be Ben's club in the future. So he's going to be the one making decisions on players, etc.
And they are playing different to what they did last year, because it is the way Ben wants them to play and play Carousella and the sort of this new game style. I think it's still clearly being bedded down, but
clearly,
yeah, I think they've also got to show respect to Johnny in the sense, Jono, that he is still the coach and will be the coach till the end of the year. And he's a premiership coach. He's sort of navigated Essendon through some pretty troubled waters, and they want to give him the due respect until the end of the season, I guess.
Yeah, look, and Blake Carousella is an awesome coach. He's shown that at the Cats. I had first-hand experience watching him go about it. Then also you've got the work he did at Richmond, which was sensational in helping, you know, mould that team to the success that they've had in the past and continue to have today. And you know, sometimes you sort of look and go, okay, with the style they're trying to play, and it might be an implementation of a few different things that, that Blake brings to the table along with the other coaches, but you've got to find the right fit for that group of players. Now, you know, we've seen coaches in the past that, you know, might have come in and had a certain style, but it just didn't suit the group. So then, you know, they've still tried to run with that, but the success hasn't come until something's come in that's maybe freed them up a little bit more and play to a style that, that suits the collective. So I think that's what Essendon is still searching for. They've played some really good footy at times, but at times they've seemed to battle as well under the type of style they're trying to play. And it is an evolution, but it's one that I'm sure, you know, they've had a fair bit of time with now, and there's no turning back. So they've got to get it right coming into a final series. You just got to make the finals, I think, this year. Yes, there's some good sides at the top end, but anything's possible this year, and we still don't know the locations and what may happen into the future. So there's still a huge chance for them to make this an excellent season for themselves.
So from a team selection perspective in the Hawthorn-Essendon game, Hawthorn's made three changes. Jack Gunston, Jonathan Segler and Darren Minchington come back into the team. They've managed Ben Stratton and Sean Burgoyne. Jarman Impey is out injured. So three important outs for the Hawks. Essendon, Phillips, Hooker and Danaher come in. So not only is the story about Joe Danaher, but Cale Hooker's missed most of the season as well. So he returns to probably the defence. Out Tom Bell Chambers injured, Aaron Francis injured, and Sam Draper has been managed. Mm. So the two ruckmen that they had in the game in Darwin are both missing, and Andrew Phillips gets another opportunity. Who are you leaning towards here, Jono? Because mathematically, both teams, if they were to win all their remaining games, would probably make the finals. It's unlikely, but it is possible. Who are you leaning towards?
I'm leaning towards the Bombers. I think with Burgoyne out of the side and Ben Stratton in particular, I think they're huge. Same with Jarman Impey. He's so important. I know he's been playing forward and he brings the energy and he brings that spark to defend with speed in that forward half of the ground. So I think that's, you know, although they've got a couple of good wins in Segler and Gunston, so have Essendon. But then you go to the Bombers and you sort of look at them and go, okay, their two ruckmen are out of the side. Again, Aaron Francis is a really important defender for them. So that's where Cale Hooker, you're right, Whitey, will have to go back. Andrew Phillips comes in to take the ruck. But yeah, I'm just leaning towards the Bombers. I think their midfield will be able to at least break even, if not beat Hawthorn's midfield, and give their forwards sort of first look at it. Across the ground, their matchups are really, really strong. I think the Danaher-Stewart combination could be quite good. And then you've got the smalls that will get to work, no doubt, in that forward half of the ground to give them enough opportunity to score. So I think Essendon by probably around 10 or so points. I think it'll be close for most of the night. That's traditionally the way it is against Hawthorn. Anyway, you've got to work hard to break them, because they're, talk about a well-coached team and structured team, that they do take a fair bit of work to get through. And from a Hawthorn point of view, I've loved the work of Will Day throughout the entire season so far. I think he's a really youngster that the Hawks should be extremely excited about in terms of what he's been able to do sort of week in, week out now for the footy club. He's becoming reasonably consistent in what he does, and you know that's only going to get better as the years go on, and they'll be pretty excited with what they've got there from the number 30.
Jono, one final one on the Essendon-Hawthorn game. You played in Darwin a lot. That week after, and how much it took out of you. Dylan Scheel said to us on Tuesday that some of the players lost as much as 4 kilos in the game, even though it was a shortened game up in Darwin. And obviously they put that weight on fairly quickly. But a short break, Saturday night into Thursday night, do you think that will have an impact on them?
It could a little bit. Yeah, I think that's really important to keep an eye on throughout the week. They might even make a couple of late changes depending on that. They'll be giving guys right up until the game to make sure that they are, or game day to make sure that they are right, which is today. So, you know, this afternoon they might have to make some decisions on players depending on recovery, because that's a lot of weight to lose, put back on, start to feel good about yourself. And yes, we played a fair bit of footy up in Darwin, as you said. We sold the home games up to Darwin. So therefore, really, we used to play up there a lot with the break next, so with the bye. So we would have then just a couple of days to recover actually in Darwin, and then travel home, have plenty of time to sort of get over, playing in those tougher conditions with, it's not so much the humidity, it's just beautiful. Actually, the weather is beautiful during the day, and it's just a bit more slippery at night. So I think overall it's just something different off a short break. Whitey, we always had a fair bit of time to recover from that game, get home, and get ourselves set for our next hit out.
Talk motor racing now with Craig Lowndes. We know him as an absolute legend of the sport of V8 supercars. He's also an expert now with Fox Sports. There's back-to-back races up in Townsville this weekend, and Craig joins us. Craig, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
How have you found this new truncated season with back-to-back races, weekend races, back-to-back? It's all a bit crammed, but we are at least getting races away, I guess.
We are. I think there's no doubt that we're all adapting to the conditions and what's going on at the moment. I think that, it was amazing to have two weekends in a row up in Darwin. A lot of, people had a chance to sort of relax, I suppose, between the two races. But now they've quickly moved to Townsville. We've got Townsville this weekend and next weekend. So, again, it's amazing the way that, we've all been able to adapt and the way that the Supercars fraternity basically is able to keep going racing. As you said, it's amazing to be able to see cars running around the tracks. And Townsville being a bit of a hybrid track, it's a bit part permanent, part street track. To have that construction up for almost now will be 3 to 4 weeks is quite incredible.
So, Craig, we've seen some sports come back in a different sort of look up for obvious reasons, and they'd be quite normal. Then other sports have come back and they've felt different. Things have been different. Some athletes have performed really well, others not so well. What have you noticed? What have you observed with the V8s? Is it been pretty much normal, or have you seen a few things different that might end up happening when we get back to normality down the track?
Well, I think that you were just mentioning about crowds coming back to racing. I think that's one of the biggest noticeable differences for what we are normally used to what it is now. The atmosphere is very different. When we're racing at Sydney Motorsport Park, we only had limited crowd on the outside. The back of the pits were very bare. It was only race crew allowed and TV crew and marshals around that section of the track. And, for me, it's I grew up with, 3 or 4 other different categories at races, and you're watching cars all day running around tracks where now it's predominantly just supercars. So there is a big difference, and I think that, as you said about the normality, there's no doubt that the changes that supercars have put on teams, limiting team personnel that travel to different sort of data or how much data they can extract out of the cars. So there's been a lot of changes within the fraternity, and I think that will become an hour norm. They're definitely trying to condense the race weekends into weekends. It sort of got blown out there for a little while. It used to be a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday races. So now I think that, the norm going forward will be more condensed racing, hopefully harder and faster. At the moment, the format is 3 races over Saturday, Sunday. I think it works really well.
Craig, when you look at the championship at the moment, Scotty McLaughlin, of course, is dominating out in front. But when you look at someone like a Nick Percat, for example, I've loved his year so far. And the way you talk about the way they condense it over the weekend, has that allowed someone like a Nick Percat and his car really strive now and put himself in a position to maybe try and push towards a top 3 finish by the end of the year?
Oh, absolutely. I think that what we've seen with the changes that Nick's had a victory. Jack LeBrock's had his first victory. You've got completely different people. Todd Hazelwood, who's another young up-and-comer out of the Brad Jones camp that, been on the podium at Sydney Motorsport Park. Definitely got some different people now. Almost a bit of a changing of the guard of drivers now coming up to the front because of the changes with the limited of the data. Engineers have got to rely on drivers' input and what they feel for what they want out of the car. So that really has condense the grid up quite a lot. But as you mentioned, Scotty McLaughlin is basically the class act at the moment. He's qualifying to then ratio to race wins is quite incredible. He's just been consistent this year where a lot of, he's had a lot of people that have, beaten him to the finish line, but, he's been the most consistent out of everyone at the moment.
In terms of, I was going to ask a personal question, Craig. In terms of your own driving, we know you're doing the Enduro Series still. Have you been able to jump in the car at all this year to have a bit of a go before we reach those events later in the year?
Well, yeah, no. The short answer is no, I haven't been in the car. And I think all the co-drivers like Garth Tander, I know he's pairing up with Shane. He's in lockdown with you guys in Victoria. And, you know, it's amazing to think that we're going to go to Bathurst, hopefully in about a month's time, when none of the co-drivers at that side of it have actually been in a race car. It's probably thankful that I know the track reasonably well. Bathurst is the only endurance track this year, so it's going to be quite interesting when we get there. That you know how much or how quickly we can get up to speed. There is talk in the background at the moment of having a couple of co-driver sessions at some of the up and coming events. So really, any time I can get into a race car, it's definitely going to be valuable. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting point. Craig, just on Scotty McLaughlin, obviously he's dominated the last couple of years and he's up there again this year. Is the gap closing, do you think, or is Scott still absolutely the dominant force of the sport?
Oh, it's definitely closing. I think that, you know, I know within the Red Bull team what they're doing to try and obviously bridge that gap. They're working really hard behind the scenes to manufacture and get the cars faster. But I think not only them, but, you know, Tigford doing a great job. I think Team 18 with Mark Winterbottom and Scott Pye did a fantastic job up in Darwin. They had great pace all weekend. So there's definitely a closing of the gap. But Scotty is a class act. There's no doubt about it. You know, he's matured over the last couple of years. You know, it's a shame with what's going on right at the moment because his plan this year was to go over to the US and compete in IndyCar at least 3 to 4 rounds of that series. And of course, with the lockdown at the moment, he can't get across there. So it's a bit of a shame. He sort of, in his career at the moment, sort of needs to now expand and go overseas if that's what he desires. And I believe it is. So he, you know, right at this stage needs to sort of secure another championship, which he looks like he's pretty good for this year. Again, he's as I said, he's dominating and doing everything right so far. But he, you know, he'll need to look at doing something else, I reckon. Overseas, hopefully next year or the year after, if that's what he wants.
Ryan Myers does join us from the Cats. Obviously, Geelong flying at the moment, and they've got a massive game tomorrow night against the Western Bulldogs. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
No worries. Thanks for having me, guys.
Now, I'm really keen to ask you straight off the top. Do you feel you're a better team this year than last year? Obviously, last year you had such a great home and away season. Do you feel that you're better as you approach another final series?
I think it's a tough question because of the different situations that we're in, but I feel both years we've put ourselves in a great position to perform. Last year we had a 20-point lead in the prelim final at halftime, so I don't think we can be much better suited than that. It was just about us finishing off the work that we've done throughout the year, put ourselves into the grand final to play off for it. But then this year we've done the work again. I think the situation that we're in does suit us comfortably compared to some other teams due to our experience and leadership of some of our players. So I don't think we have to be worried going to a final series that we can't perform. I'm pretty excited for it.
Brian, when you look through the midfield, you've got your out-and-out superstars, of course, and the rise of Cam Guthrie this year, I think more consistently, has been quite outstanding. From a teammate's point of view, what have you seen within Cam that you think has allowed him to take his game consistently to a really high level?
Yeah, him and Sam Menegola both have really come on the scene and been so consistent for us this year. But for Cam, like, I think just giving him the opportunity to be one of the star midfielders in our team, I think he just hasn't really had that chance. Well, since I've been here, he hasn't had that chance to show his capabilities. And this year, getting a free run at it on the ball, and I think he's taken his game to a new level also. So it's pretty good to watch and it's pretty good to receive from him.
Ryan, a lot's been spoken about resting over the last couple of months, especially with teams going into the hubs. Since you made your debut, you've played essentially 38 games in a row. Any chance of a rest, or are you wanting a rest in the next couple of weeks?
I hope not. I don't know what the coaches were thinking. I'll let them decide on that kind of thing, but I'm just getting my body right for each game, and I've been suited to the short turnaround, so I think my body feels better off the 4-day break than it did off the 9-day break. So I'm pretty excited to just keep playing, and hopefully they keep picking me and I'm good to go.
Brian, and how are you feeling at the moment? You say they're not too bad, but the way you're playing, you do have to get right up the field. You are that outlet at times we see from, you know, out of the back half. You're feeling like you've got the legs left in you to run out the entire season?
Yeah, definitely. I think over the big pre-season we had and then the extended pre-season, I don't think I could be fitter coming into this little block of games, and that's just because of how much running I had to do from October until April, I think it was. So it was a lot of running sessions I had to get done, and I feel I'm as fit as I could have been. And it's probably the hardest thing to get up for each game through the 4-day break, the mental side of it. But I feel I'm coping with that well at the moment.
Is it good at the moment as well, Grime, when you're walking down to the forward line at the start of the game and you know you've got big Tommy Hawkins in unbelievable form?
Of course it is.
And Grime, you've got the Dogs this week, of course. So what are you looking at from a team point of view to try and, you know, pick apart a team that's back in some sort of form as well?
Yeah, they're looking really good. And I think for us, we pretty much just have to go into it. I think a lot of teams are doing that this year. You kind of just got to back your own method. You haven't got the full week and the full time to worry about other teams as much as other years, and you put more time into it through training and practicing against the way they play, where this week we've pretty much got a captain's run and that's all we've got until the game. So it's more just backing your own game plan in and trusting what you guys do, and if we play well, I do think we can win, but that's also the risk. If they play well, they can also win. So I think we just go back ourselves in and we just try and play our best.
Grime, we've been sort of speculating a little bit with the Cats over the last few weeks that we feel you're moving the ball a bit quicker and getting the ball in there a bit quicker inside 50 to the likes of Tom, but also yourself, and also you've got a number of different players down there inside 50, whether it's Gary Rowan or whoever it is down there. Is that happening? Do you feel that it's been a conscious thing to try and get it in a bit quicker?
Yeah, definitely. I think there was a game against Collingwood where our offense got really halted. But since then, I think we changed a few things and kind of just told everyone, just have the confidence to back your legs and take the game on a bit more. We were a bit conservative during that game, I felt. So since then, I think it's quite changed. Obviously, Hawks hit some rare form, but I think we're complimenting him well around the field. Like Gary Rowan popped out for a lot of goals the last few weeks, but others been doing it the other weeks. And I think the trust that the mids have for us forward is doing really well for the team.
Caleb Daniel is there to join us from the Bulldogs. Caleb, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, guys.
We're talking about the Bulldogs throughout the course of the week. The win against Melbourne, it seemed quite a sort of a pivotal moment potentially in your season, the way that you really kicked away in that second half. How much confidence did the team get out of that performance last week?
Yeah, we got a lot of confidence. I think we were able to play sort of more of a consistent brand for a lot more of the game. I suppose, like you said, that third quarter really set up the win, and we got a lot of momentum from that. So that was great. And Melbourne are a really good side. So they had a couple of pretty big wins in the weeks previously, so put them away sort of in that third quarter was really good from the boys.
Have you noticed anything different? Obviously, the team's a bit more settled now since Lockie's come back into the team, and even Josh back into that midfield. Is it as simple as that, or has there been some tinkerings to the way you've decided to play the game?
There's been a few tinkerings, I guess. I suppose we've really focused on our defence the last couple of weeks and just getting that right and the little things throughout the team defence. So there's been some tinkering through that. And I suppose the ball movement side of things, it's just to free your mind and play what's in front of you, play on instinct and take the game on, I guess.
Caleb, your field kicking is superb. I absolutely love watching it every week. Is it something you've always been good at, both left and right foot?
No, not really. I think when I was younger, my family or dad and mum sort of tried to get me to kick it a fair bit left-footed and sort of said that it would help you in the long run if you're able to make it into the sort of
into the elite sort of grades. But I sort of took me a little while to really establish that. But I suppose left foot just came from practice, and so did all the other field kicking. I suppose we get the footies out from this right at the start of the season. So we train every training session with them.
And tell us how you've found this season personally. Obviously, a few challenges, obviously, with the hubs and coming in and out of them in different states. How's it gone for you?
It's obviously a unique situation, but I think the team and the people that, can adapt to it as quick and as well as possible are going to be going pretty well. So I think it's been obviously unique, like I said, but you just try and take the positives out of it. We're pretty lucky to be in the situation that we're in, not in Victoria, but one sort of thing, and we're able to sort of play footy together and do what we love doing and putting on a show for those guys that can't do as much as us.
Now, I know your housemate is Bailey Williams, and he's been giving you plenty of stick. There's a rumour going around that he's trying to pinch a couple of the kick-ins as well. Can you confirm or deny it, Caleb?
I'll massively confirm. He's a massive pinch. Every time I'm sort of working around, if he's sort of around the square, he tells me he hasn't had a kick in 10 minutes or so he can get a quick cheap one. But no, I'm loving the way that he's going about it. He's kicking footy really well and he's playing some really good footy. So happy to give a couple over.
It can be one of the most intimidating kicks, especially when we have the benefit a lot of the time this year of the behind-the-goals vision. Do you actually enjoy taking the kick out? I mean, it's quite a lot of responsibility to take on.
It is, I suppose, a lot of responsibility. There's always a bailout kick there if you need it. And I suppose that's the thing that you got to take on if the defence is really good. But I think it kickstarts a lot of the ball movement from opposing teams and your team. So if you can get that kick in right and get it to attacking spots, then it helps, I suppose, get the footy down the other end and hopefully through the big stick.
How much of it, Caleb, is sort of set play type situations, and how much of it is you being essentially able to sense the situation and make your own decisions and have a bit of a licence?
Oh, there's always sort of set plays that the coach draws up and that sort of stuff. But obviously, when teams scout you and teams do different things, they're going to get shut off pretty quickly, or you go from once or twice in the game. That's probably two times that they're going to cotton on to what you're doing. So I suppose it in the end, it comes down to your decision making, and if the options are right and if the teams in a good position to be, I suppose, take the mark or get the ball going forward.
Well, it was a big moment for Victorian cricket yesterday. They finally announced their new coach. It's been a long process and a fairly dramatic process towards the end because some of the biggest names in the game domestically here in Australia were after the job as coach of Victoria, and it was Chris Rogers that won the race, and he joins us now on RSN. Chris, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks, Ed. How are you, mate?
I'm going well, but not as well as you, I'm sure. That was great news to hear yesterday.
Yeah, it was. This is one of the great roles in Australian cricket, really. There's so much talent, so many people playing cricket in Melbourne and Victoria. So to get that role, be head coach, is one to be very excited about.
And it was a fairly exhaustive process that you had to go through to get the role. Can you explain a little bit about what you had to do and also maybe a bit of a background in how you've got to this point since so many of us cricket fans saw you playing for Australia?
As for the process itself, I think in previous times, Victoria have been directed by Sean Graff, the general manager who really is probably had a bit of an idea who he wanted at the time. But this time around, there was a few names who were in the hat. So, yeah, we had to go through a couple of interviews. We had a couple of different panels we had to present to. And yeah, that was it kind of came down to two, I think, in the end, and I was lucky enough to get it. But as for me, I guess I had the coaching bug towards the end of, well, almost always through my career, but particularly towards the end, and started to do a bit before I finished playing, and then did a little bit in England. I was an assistant coach over in Somerset for a year, and Gloucester a couple of times for short periods, and then had a 2-year role with Cricket Australia, just working with the best young players coming through the system throughout Australia. So I've had some fantastic experiences and really good mentors as well who have helped me kind of grow as a coach, because it's one of those ones that play, you step out as a player, think you know a lot about the game, but coaching is a skill, and you know it takes time to learn. So it's been one I've really enjoyed over the last few years, and will continue to do so.
How much or how important was that time up with Cricket Australia? Because as you said, you've always almost been a coach when you were playing, particularly in county cricket, but just that, I guess, that additional time as more a specialised coaching position, how much did that help sort of round you off a little bit?
Oh, yeah, tremendously. I mean, it's all good to kind of hear about the game, but it's understanding people's personalities, you know, that there's so many people are motivated by different things and they respond differently to different methods. So, you know, like I think working with younger men as well, you know, it's really challenging because, you know, a lot of them think that they know what they're doing, and then they're far off. But yeah, it's just kind of making sure that you're understanding what makes them tick and what they want, and trying to make sure you're not, you know, just teaching them the one way, which, you know, I probably was a little bit guilty of when I finished playing. So just continually growing and like I said, surrounding myself with good people who can help.
Chris, would you have gone anywhere to coach, or was there something in particular about the Victorian job that attracted you?
Andrew, I probably would have gone anywhere. I think as a coach, you have to be prepared to go anywhere. I mean, it's not like, you know, you lose a job and you can just go around the corner, unless it was Renegades and Stars. But, you know, it's, that's not very common. So yeah, I think that if you want to kind of coach at the top level, you just got to be prepared to move, and they're the sacrifices you make along the way. But that's part of it.
How much has coaching evolved, even in probably the last 5 years? We probably thought that you know, we had an idea of what cricket coaching was, but you talk about the evolvement of coaching. What do you think has been the major shift in, say, the last five years?
I think we've taken a little bit of a lead from AFL in many respects. You look at someone like Damien Hardwick and the kind of the way that he's developed, you know, through his own experiences and going over to the States to try and learn and develop as well, and probably coming back as a more empathetic coach who you know, appreciates how hard the game still is and finding different ways to communicate. So, I think probably from my point of view, it's probably less about the wins and losses, but more about the process. You know, trying to really make sure that you're helping getting people get better, and then the results take care of themselves. And you know, I'm probably talking a little bit in cliches there, but for me, you know, that's the way I'm probably looking to approach it, and hopefully get those results, because I'm well aware that, you know, that Victoria is a very proud and successful state when it comes to cricket. So there's pressure on that as well.
And I think that's, I guess, one of the real interesting sort of parts about Victorian cricket, Chris, is that they win a lot. I mean, they've won 6 Shield titles in a short period of time, and even the short form format as well have always been very successful. But not a lot of test representation or international representation. Do you have a view on that and a focus on trying to get the next generation through the likes of Pekoski and Sutherland and these types? Or is it about winning? Is it about both? How do you juggle that?
It is a juggle. I think it's a fine balance. You know, you can have the approach that, yeah, we win at all costs and then you get players into playing for Australia. And I think Victoria tried that and it wasn't as successful as they hoped. So I think there's a definitely a push from the powers that be that, you know, that they want players playing for Australia and not just being selected but being permanent fixtures in the side. So there's therefore the pressure on the coaching staff to help these players really develop those all-round skills that they're going to need if they go and play for Australia. Because if you go and play for Australia, it's things like in other parts of the world, 60% of the bowling will be done by spinners, you know, whereas over here it might be 5% at some of the state grounds. So it's little things like that. How do you find ways to kind of develop players all round so that they can go on to play, represent and play well for Australia? And you know, there's lots of other different skills as well. So, yeah, I'm highly aware of all these kind of things. I don't think it's just going to be solved tomorrow, but, you know, hopefully we can put in some processes that can help these players, you know, develop their all-round game.
The Breakfast Club.